This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The focus of the 9/11 Commission this morning was the CIA, and the witness was the Director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet. The questions centered on the failure of the intelligence community to learn about the attacks and to disrupt them. The CIA, of course, is not the only intelligence agency to come in for criticism this week. Later in the program, we'll talk about a controversial proposal to revamp the FBI and create a separate domestic intelligence service. But first, a summary of today's testimony. Joining us here in Studio 3A is NPR correspondent Pam Fessler. She's been watching the hearings. Hi, Pam.
Hello.
Today began with a staff statement on the performance of the intelligence community. This was, as we're going to hear later, considered by the commission a damning indictment of the Central Intelligence Agency.
That's correct, Neil. It was not actually unlike the report that the staff released yesterday about the FBI. It painted a picture of an agency that was suffering from budget shortfalls, even at a time, and personnel cutbacks, even at a time when the demands were being placed on the agency were growing. It talks specifically about how the intelligence community analyzed the al-Qaeda threat. Mm-hmm. It said that even though there was a knowledge for quite a while that al-Qaeda was a terrorist network, let me just read one quick thing from the report. It says, we now know it was formed, the al-Qaeda network, in 1988 at the end of the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, but the intelligence community did not describe this organization, at least in documents we have seen, until 1999. They were still talking about Osama bin Laden as a terrorist financier, even though there was information at the time that he was responsible for some serious attacks.
The statement was read by Commission Executive Director Philip Zelikow, and in the course of it, he mentioned several warnings that airplanes might be used as weapons. Let's listen to an excerpt of what he had to say.
The CTC did not propose, and the intelligence community collection management process did not set collection requirements against such telltale indicators. Therefore, the warning system was not looking for information, such as the July 2001 FBI report of terrorist interest in various kinds of aircraft training in Arizona, or the August 2001 arrest of Zacharias Moussaoui because of his suspicious behavior in a Minnesota flight school. In late August, the Moussaoui arrest was briefed to the DCI and other top CIA officials under the heading, quote, Islamic extremist learns to fly, close quote. The news had no evident effect on warning.
And Pam, we're going to have to be explaining alphabet soup throughout this summary. CTC, the Counterterrorism Center, of course, DCI is the Director of Central Intelligence, in this case, George Tenet, the man who was in the chair. And the conclusion was that the CIA had no strategic plan to address the threat of al-Qaeda.
Exactly. And especially, I mean, this is a very telling example about the information about the possibility of using planes as weapons and hijackings, that they were collecting the information, but not coming up with an overall plan on how to deal with it, how to predict it, what type of information they might want to collect to in fact, analyze whether or not some type of a plot was taking place. And as the staff pointed out, maybe if they had done this, all of these little signs that we saw in the year and the months leading up to 9/11, somebody might have started picking up the clues.
Mm-hmm. How did Director Tenet respond to the staff criticism?
Well, he agreed that, in fact, that he had to deal with a lot of budget cutbacks, that he was, when he took over the agency in the 1990s, it was suffering from a lot of personnel reductions. Mm-hmm. They lost about 25% of their personnel. And he said that they, in fact, obviously failed in the end because they were not able to prevent the September 11th attack or penetrate the al-Qaeda network and discover the plot ahead of time. However, he did say that he took issue with the commission's report saying that they did not have an overall bin Laden strategy. He said even though it was not a formal one written out, that they did, in fact, from the late 1990s on, have a plan to deal with al-Qaeda, and that they were working very hard on that. But he also admitted that they had to rely on foreign intelligence sources and what they call walk-ins, people who might come into a U.S. embassy and say, you know, this is what I've been hearing. And those things are very hard to determine whether they're true or not. And we really didn't have very good sources of our own inside the al-Qaeda network.
And Commission Member John Layman, the Secretary of the Navy under President Reagan, was particularly blistering in his criticism of the CIA, and this is what he had to say.
That report that you heard this morning was a damning report, not of your actions or the actions of any of the really superb and dedicated people that you have, but it was a damning evaluation of a system that is broken, that doesn't function. And all I have to do is reread the PDB, which the agency resisted so strongly our declassifying. And the key line is, we have not been able to corroborate some of the more sensational threat reporting, like the intention of bin Laden to hijack U.S. aircraft. All the king's horses and all the king's men in CIA could not corroborate what turned out to be true, and told the President of the United States almost a month before the attack that they couldn't corroborate these reports. That's an institutional failure. And I'm here to tell you, and I'm sure you've heard it before, there is a train coming down the track. There are going to be very real changes made.
And alphabet soup again. PDB, you probably already know, was the presidential daily brief from August 6, 2001 that caused so much kerfuffle over the past couple of weeks in Condoleezza Rice's testimony last week. But in terms of the train coming down the track, as former Secretary Layman was putting it, this is talk about reform of the intelligence services.
That's right, Neil. Actually, the purpose of this commission is not only to find out what went wrong before 9/11 and in the weeks possibly after, but to make recommendations on what changes to make. The commissioners say that they're not in the business of pointing fingers, but that they want to, in fact, come up with some proposals that will be adopted. Now, of course, the question is, when they do make these proposals, what in fact will happen? Obviously, they cannot make the changes. Congress has to approve them, and the administration does as well.
One of the things that has been consistent throughout the testimony, and this has been from all sorts of officials, former secretaries of state, national security advisors, Clinton and Bush administration, has been that there was no consensus before 9/11 to be at war against al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda was at war against us. We were not yet at war with them. And that, in fact, the country was not prepared to back what would have been a preemptive invasion of Afghanistan. It would have been extremely difficult. Pakistan wasn't with us. And there was an interesting point in today's testimony when the former senator from Nebraska, the Democrat Bob Kerry, addressed this. And he said that this was, as you'll hear, a central point.
The reason I think this is central, because we have heard, I've heard a series of excuses from Sandy Berger, Bill Cohen, Madeleine Albright, Don Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, all kinds of rationalizations. And one of the things I've heard over and over and over was the American public wouldn't have supported any action had we taken action before 9/11. Now, I got to tell you, I think if the President of the United States of America had come and said that Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda is responsible for shooting down a Black Hawk helicopter in Mogadishu in 1993, I believe that speech would have galvanized the United States of America against bin Laden. And would have prevented, I think, would have given you permission to do operations that you didn't have permission to do, would have changed the whole dynamic. I mean, I just can't believe that if the President of the United States had said that in 1994, 95, 96, I mean, whenever you get the walk-in in 96, if he'd have done it in 96 or 97, I just can't believe the public opinion wouldn't have been on his side just like that.
And that, of course, the former Democratic senator from Nebraska, Bob Kerry. Now, this is really taking it outside of the ambit of just the Central Intelligence Agency or the counterterrorism at the FBI or at the White House or anywhere else. This puts it squarely back on national politicians.
Well, that's right. And I think there's an incredible frustration in these hearings that we're looking at everything that happened after 9/11. We're looking at what happened before 9/11 with a different perspective, a post-9/11 perspective. And several of the witnesses and the commissioners themselves have said, well, you know, in hindsight, it looks so obvious why Were the dots not connected? Why did people act the way they did? Why wasn't this information shared, as Senator Kerry, former Senator Kerry mentioned? You know, why weren't we told about Osama bin Laden's link with these attacks? If we had known, then the country would have been willing to act. Well, you know, the question is, would it have? And you know, it was a very different mindset then. And as some of the former Clinton officials brought out in earlier testimony, when President Clinton had retaliated against Osama bin Laden in 1998 after the African embassy bombings, he was accused of overreacting, and in fact, there was a wag the tail scenario that was raised. Wag the dog, I'm sorry. that he was only doing it to divert attention from his own Monica Lewinsky scandal.
In something of a response to Senator Kerry's frustrations, Director Tenet of the CIA said at a couple of different points that they were aware of the general threat from bin Laden, the desire on his part to attack inside the United States, but that they couldn't properly act on it.
We all understood bin Laden's attempt to strike the homeland, but we never translated this knowledge into an effective defense of the country. Doing so would have complicated the terrorist calculation of the difficulty in succeeding in a vast open society that, in effect, was unprotected on September 11th. During periods of heightened threat, we undertook smart, disciplined actions, but ultimately all of us must acknowledge that we did not have the data, the span of control, the redundancy, the fusion, or the laws in place to give us the chance to compensate for the mistakes that will always be made in any human endeavor. This is not a clinical excuse. 3,000 people died. It was not, no matter how hard we worked or how desperately we tried, it was not enough. The victims and the families of 9/11 deserve better.
As close as Director Tenet came to an apology for a failure to detect the plan ahead of time.
That's right. And we've been hearing a lot of this actually ever since Richard Clark, the former counterterrorism coordinator, apologized in the beginning of his testimony to the families of the 9/11 victims. Actually, every single witness that's come up has expressed some sort of sorrow at what's happened, and without taking any responsibility necessarily, has expressed different degrees of regret. One thing I just wanted to note with Tenet's comments, you know, when talking about how you look at the intelligence, it should also be said that in this summer before 9/11, all of the officials say that most of the intelligence that we were receiving about the possibility of the threat was indicating that the attack was going to take place overseas, that's where officials' mindset was. Even though they knew there was always a possibility of an attack inside the United States, the specific intelligence that they had in that summer was all pointing overseas.
And getting back to your point about the future and how to restructure intelligence services and agencies and all of that to prevent future attacks, in his testimony, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency said this was all going to take some considerable time.
We've spent an enormous amount of time and energy transforming our collection, operational, and analytic capabilities. The first thing I would say to the Commission is that the care and nurturing of these capabilities is absolutely essential. It will take us another 5 years to have the kind of clandestine service our country needs. There is a creative, innovative strategy to get us there that requires sustained commitment, leadership, and funding. The same can be said for our other disciplines. Something has to be said about the importance of intelligence and how we look at this discipline for the country quite publicly.
A very controversial statement, but obviously the director there talking about some changes that have already been made. This afternoon here in Washington, the commission is hearing from the current director of the FBI, Robert Mueller. Of course, you should stay tuned to NPR News for details on what he has to say about proposed reforms. We're going to be discussing proposed reforms for the FBI when we come back from a short break, and that's the creation of a separate domestic intelligence agency. But Pam Fessler, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
If you have ever worked for the FBI, had direct experience of counterterrorism, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. As we heard before the break, the CIA has come in for its share of withering criticism by the 9/11 Commission, but the heaviest fire thus far has been directed at the FBI. Yesterday we heard that the FBI failed to share information with other agencies and even within the FBI itself, information that might have enabled analysts to connect the dots and unravel al-Qaeda's plan to attack. One possible reform that's been discussed both in and outside the hearings is the creation of a separate counterintelligence agency. It would be separate from the FBI. Obviously, the charter, powers, and size of such an agency is speculative at this point. It's not clear how it would fit into the government structure exactly, but there are precedents to look at and a debate that's already underway. In a few minutes, we'll talk with former officials from the FBI and the CIA about the pros and cons of a domestic intelligence service, and we want to hear from you. Given the failures of 9/11, is it time to remove counterintelligence from the FBI? What are the risks? What are the promises? Our phone number is 800-989-8255, and our email address is totn@npr.org. The RAND Corporation asked many of those questions about the domestic intelligence agencies that already exist in four industrialized democracies in Britain, France, Australia, and Canada. The study was conducted by Peter Chalk, and he joins us now on the phone from his offices in Santa Monica, California. Good of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
You're more than welcome. Thanks for having me on.
You wrote that the four security agencies share important strengths. What are they?
Well, the agencies, because they are divested from dual law enforcement roles, have been able to devote the sum total of their resources to intelligence and information collection, analysis, and dissemination. And that, in turn, has availed an emphasis on the production of regular threat assessments that have straddled both strategic and tactical dimensions. And it's also in many ways encouraged a recruitment pool from a sector of the population that would not normally be attracted to going into a law enforcement career because analysts are fast-tracked right into their role. You're typically seeing linguists, historians, political scientists, going into that discipline, whereas where the intelligence agency and law enforcement function is meshed, the availability of that sort of recruitment pool is not always there. The other major aspect that we found was that there was a very, very heavy reliance on human intelligence, and in many cases, that superseded the importance given to electronic eavesdropping, for instance. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of reliance on using insiders or informers, and that seemed to be fairly effective in terms of penetration of cells that were existing in each of the respective states.
And this is, and again, I want to get to the structural differences between these agencies and, for example, our FBI, and the difference is that lack of enforcement powers. These agencies in Canada, France, Britain, and Germany, they can't arrest anybody.
That's correct. They are mandated specifically with the role of collecting, analyzing, and disseminating information. They have no detention powers and they have no arrest powers. The one exception to that was Australia, that under their version of the Patriot Act, I guess, they have recently instituted very, very limited modalities that will allow ASIO, the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation, to detain and question terrorist suspects. But that was the exception rather than the rule.
Now, in addition to the strengths you mentioned a moment ago, you also found some weaknesses that all of these agencies share.
Yeah, in many cases, information flow between the intelligence agencies and the police was not two-way. There was a perception in a number of countries that information that was given to the intelligence services disappeared into a big black hole and never came out again. So it wasn't a sort of a free flow of information that was two-way. There were also instances when each of the agencies had violated democratic norms in the name of counterterrorism or had engaged in surveillance activities that were at odds with their written mandates, mm-hmm. particularly in terms of what you would probably refer to as political surveillance, which occurred in the UK and Australia. And in the French case, there were what are known as mopping up exercises whereby the intelligence services played a key role in directing mass roundups of suspected Islamic militants following attacks, even though there was no direct information that they were connected directly or indirectly to terrorist activity.
Now, given those strengths and weaknesses, did you reach any conclusion about whether a separate domestic intelligence agency would work in this country, given, of course, we have historic and cultural differences between us and all of those other places?
No, we didn't. The thrust of the report was to actually inform the debate, and what we wanted to do was to look at how some of these agencies worked and to see if any of the lessons that we derived from the study could be extrapolated and applied to the U.S. context, either within the sphere of reform of the FBI or with respect to the possible creation of an entirely new structure. So we weren't really out there to look and see the a viability of a domestic intelligence structure in the United States per se, rather to see what lessons could be gleaned from the experiences of other states.
And if you had to summarize those lessons, what do you think they'd be?
Well, greater reliance on human intelligence, the institution of coordinating mechanisms to try and expedite the flow of information, classified information to the local level, the institution of rigorous checks and balances to ensure that surveillance activities are carried out with due consideration given to democratic norms, which often requires independent mechanisms of oversight and review. Certainly, when those mechanisms are not in place, the credibility and public confidence of these agencies suffers quite considerably.
And one of the cultural differences that exists in the United States is a different attitude about civil liberties.
Oh, absolutely. You have what is referred to as a fear of Big Brother government, and that's combined with the historical legacy here in the sense that the United States hasn't really had to deal with domestic terrorism on a concerted basis. And so the accepted willingness of the public to allow for concerted surveillance in a domestic context has not been as great as it has been, say, in a place like the United Kingdom, which has been dealing with terrorism related to Northern Ireland for many years.
Peter Chalk, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Peter Chalk is a policy analyst at the RAND Corporation. They just released a report called Confronting the Enemy Within: Security, Intelligence, the Police, and Counterterrorism in Four Democracies. And he spoke with us from his office in Santa Monica, California. Well, joining us now are two former officials who've worked at the FBI and CIA. Oliver Buck Revell was Associate Deputy Director of the FBI, responsible for investigative and intelligence operations. He joins us on the phone from his office in Dallas, Texas. Good to have you on the program.
Good to be with you.
And Phil Giraldi was a counterterrorism specialist at the CIA. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Buck Revell is a former FBI agent. What's your reaction to the proposal that we just heard outlined by Peter Chalk?
Well, I think it's certainly an issue that's going to be examined by both the commission and probably by congressional committees. I think it would be dead wrong for the United States. I have dealt with all these agencies. We had excellent rapport, and we had many joint cases with them. They come from a very different societal structure and a different mentality. Much of what they do could not be done in the United States, even under a time of war. And, for instance, in the UK, they can arrest without warrants. They can hold without charge. They can have trials without juries. They can have electronic surveillance without court order. I don't think we're ready to give up those provisions of our society, our laws and requirements. And what really needs to happen and what seems to be missing from this, people keep talking about reforming the FBI and reforming the CIA. They need to be empowered. They need to be empowered to deal with the reality of facing terrorism. There were absolute legal impediments to doing what is now being asked of the FBI, and there were certainly resource limitations and other restrictions on the CIA, on human intelligence, who they could deal with, under what circumstances, and the authority to hire the kind of analysts and translators they needed to be able to function in the areas of the world where they now need to be proactive.
Phil Giraldi, from your perspective, what do you think about this idea?
Well, I basically agree with what Buck said. I think there were a lot of impediments for effective action against terrorism, both on the part of the FBI and the CIA. But I also would note something that's being obscured in all of this debate. Watching George Tenet today, very much this was very much George Tenet defending George Tenet. I think that both at the agency and at the Bureau, there's been an enormous failure of the leadership. I think at the working levels in both these organizations, there was a real genuine awareness of the threat imposed by al-Qaeda. And in particular, in the case of al-Qaeda, this the menace of this threat really was not conveyed to the White House, at least in terms of the White House taking effective action against these groups.
Buck Revelle, I wanted to ask you one specific question about one of the things that Peter Chalk said, and that is the nature of those who would be attracted to applying for this service. He said very different kinds of recruits come into what would in Britain be MI5 than what would have come into a law enforcement agency, in their case, Scotland Yard.
Well, that may be true in the UK. It is not true in the United States. The FBI, since World War II, has had the counterintelligence responsibility and has recruited people who had both language and area knowledge and skills, analytical skills, for the counterintelligence program. And that was ongoing in the counterterrorism program, but counterterrorism had covered a much wider area than the CI program. The CI program was essentially focused on the Soviet Union after World War II, and to a lesser extent, its allies and the Chinese. But certainly the Bureau has the ability to recruit the kind of people that are needed, as does the agency. It's just that they did not have the opportunity to do so, both by restraints and by budget limitations.
But to be fair, Mr. Giraldi, a lot of these cutbacks in the CIA and to some degree at the FBI and counterterrorism as well, this was after the end of the Cold War and was getting rid of apparatus that was designed, as we just heard from Buck Revelle, to look at the former Soviet Union and its allies. These were not assets that were immediately applicable to al-Qaeda.
Well, that's very much true, but at the same time, when that happened, when the Soviet Union collapsed, it was time to look at emerging threats. And it would have behooved both the FBI leadership and the CIA leadership to look at these threats in a realistic way and begin, for example, training people in the Central Asian languages or the Middle Eastern languages that both organizations are extremely deficient in. This was again, it's a management failure because management sets the priorities in both organizations and management allocates the resources. So when George Tenet and others cry wolf and say that basically, look, the resources are not there, basically George Tenet is responsible for the resources not being there.
We're speaking about a proposal to reform the FBI, and that is to create a separate domestic intelligence service. And it's something that the former director of the FBI, Louis Freeh, mentioned yesterday before the 9/11 Commission, where he opposed this proposal. Let's hear what Louis Freeh had to say about it.
With respect to the jurisdiction of the FBI, I do not believe that we should establish a separate domestic intelligence agency with respect to counterterrorism. I think that would be a huge mistake for the country for a number of reasons. One, I don't think in the United States we will tolerate very well what in effect is a secret, state secret police. Even with all of the protections and the constitutional entitlements that we would subscribe with. Americans, I don't think, like secret police, and you would, in effect, be establishing secret police. Secondly, if you look at the models around the world where this has been tried, it hasn't worked very well, in my opinion. The other thing, it would take a long time to integrate. If the Homeland Security Department and 170,000 people to be integrated is going to take a couple of years, standing up a brand new domestic intelligence agency would take a decade, and we would lose very precious time at a very dangerous time for the United States.
Former FBI Director Louis Freeh speaking yesterday before the 9/11 Commission. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. If you'd like to join us, by the way, 800-989-8255. And we'll begin with Richard, who's joining us from Annapolis, Maryland.
Yes, hi.
Hi, you're on the air, Richard.
Yes, I think the whole situation is being misstated. The purpose of an intelligence agency is to expeditiously report any indication of an imminence of hostilities. I mean, that's its raison d'etre. That's precisely why it exists. And when it fails to perform that function, it is just that, a total failure. Now, I think the misdirection and blaming the FBI, although the FBI does have some problems, okay, in this particular case, is a disservice, not just to the FBI, but to the nation as a whole. And any discussion of increasing the, quote, architecture or structure of the system is also misdirection and a disservice to the country. Architecture does not prevent a threat from the completion of a threat. Only the reporting of that information does that. And one agency in particular is responsible for that failure, and it's not the FBI.
I take it you're pointing the finger at the Central Intelligence Agency there.
Well, specifically, yes.
Okay. Well, let's get a reaction from Phil Girardi and Mr. Revel. We'll ask you to weigh in, too, if you can both keep it short so we can get it in inside the segment. Yeah,
I don't disagree. I mean, if you set up a $30 billion structure and the purpose is to collect intelligence to protect your country, and you fail in the case of 9/11 and you fail egregiously in the case of Iraq, then there's something wrong. But I persist in believing, as I think you're suggesting, that the working levels of these organizations are basically a lot healthier than the leadership level and the interface that goes on to bring this information before the policymakers.
Just a note that, to be fair to Mr. Tenet, he's the director of Central Intelligence, but about 80% of the intelligence budget goes to other agencies, most of them within DOD, the great lion's share. Buck Revel, get your reaction.
Well, I was responsible for the terrorism program from 1980 to 1991, and in 1982, I recommended to then Director Bill Webster that we elevate counterterrorism to a national priority on par with organized crime, white collar crime, and counterintelligence. He agreed to that, and we started moving resources that we had the authority to move. Now, there is limited ability within the FBI to move resources without the approval of the Justice Department and the Congress, because the FBI is on a budget that, in fact, goes by program. And if you reprogram funds, you've got to get congressional approval. We gradually built up against the threat that existed then, which, of course, was there was a great deal of domestic terrorism, but it also came from, including Puerto Rican, which is domestic, but it came from the Sikh extremists and extremists from various parts of the world. Not from the Middle East. The Middle East terrorism certainly was of interest to us, but it was occurring in other parts of the world, and it wasn't until essentially the attack on the World Trade Center in 93 that we really had our first attack by Middle East terrorists within the United States.
Richard, thank you very much for the call. And we'll be back with more of your calls and more with Buck Revel and Phil Girardi after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As the 9/11 Commission hearings continue, we're talking today about one proposal that may emerge about restructuring the FBI, and that's to create a separate domestic intelligence services modeled perhaps along the lines of MI5 as it currently exists in Britain. Our guests are Buck Revel, former Associate Deputy Director of the FBI, who was responsible for investigative and intelligence operations. As we heard before the break, one of his responsibilities was counterintelligence. And we're also joined by Phil Giraldi, a former counterterrorism specialist at the CIA. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Ted, who joins us from the Baltimore-Washington Parkway on his way to Washington, D.C.
Yes, hi. How are you today?
Very well. I hope you're driving carefully.
Well, actually, I'm pulled over to the side of the road, and the state trooper just checked to make sure all was okay, and I told him I was talking to you, and he said, fine, so I guess I'm safe.
Well, and you're a model for all of our cell phone callers, but go ahead.
That's correct. I've been a member of the intelligence community since the early 1970s until I left in the mid-90s, and I've been in the private sector ever since, supporting the interagency in the past couple of years with the war on terrorism. And I want to speak a little bit about the culture within the intelligence community based on those almost 30 years of experience. The one of your previous callers mentioned it's the responsibility of the intelligence community to collect and report on information. And he's correct, except he leaves out a critical piece, and that's what I want to address, and that's the analysis. And what I'm talking about is added value predictive analysis. We spend a lot of money, and we have a lot of systems, smart systems, that collect data and that fuse data, but it still requires an analyst to put it together and come up with what he or she thinks is going to happen. What I feel has transpired over the years in the intelligence community is that decision makers tend to focus on that 20% or whatever it is that an intelligence analyst is wrong. And, you know, if you want to get a lead angle on the target, so to speak, you have to take a certain amount of risk. You have to put all the pieces together and sit and say, okay, this is my best judgment based on my expertise and experience on what I think all these pieces mean. But you, the decision maker, have to accept that I'm not going to be right about 20% of the time. Make your decisions, but don't fault me for the 20%. Accept and acknowledge that I'll be right 80% of the time. And what has happened, especially with younger intelligence analysts, is that they've become gun-shy. So I think that's part of the problem within the intelligence community.
Phil Giraldi, is he right?
Yes, he is to a certain extent. But in the case of Iraq, certainly, the analysts were wrong 100% of the time because the way they were analyzing the issue was fundamentally flawed. They were assuming that past behavior on the part of Saddam Hussein would predict future behavior. And going from that premise, virtually every analysis they did regarding Iraq was incorrect.
Mm-hmm. And that also based on the what happened back in 1991 when, in fact, he had many more weapons programs than they had
exactly.
anticipated. Yeah,
exactly.
And again, Buck Revelle, do you think Ted has a good point?
I think he does. I sat on the National Foreign Intelligence Board from 89 to 91 through the Gulf, the first Desert Storm. And we reviewed all of the intelligence community's estimates that were going to go to the president. And I thought the quality of analysis then was extremely good. But we did see at that time that there was a lack of resources in the analytical community that really had good expertise in the area, as well as the languages. And at the time, we thought that was a very important part to ramp up. I'm afraid that it has never caught up with where we hoped it would be. But analysis is extremely important, and very frankly, my former agency, the Bureau, has not had enough analysis, and it's very difficult because in the Bureau, we were required to work on a case-by-case basis. The law did not allow you to have a broad collection process, and so you had to piece together bits of information from different cases, so it was difficult for the analyst to really have as comprehensive a view as they could in the CIA or the DIA.
Ted, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And continue driving safely.
Thank you. Good day.
Following up on his point, though, here's an email from Gail in San Antonio. I'm recently retired from a federal agency. I worked in the field for most of my career. I had the opportunity to work with the higher-ups for about a year. During that time, I was shocked to see how little regard these people had for the employees who worked in the field. The very people who could provide the best feedback to the agency were considered irrelevant and shunned because of their lower rank. It seems that as individuals climb the ladder, they become self-important, and advice, information, and feedback from underlings was a threat. Perhaps we need to really reevaluate this tendency in human nature. It seems so predictable and an obvious weakness for terrorists to exploit. And Buck Revelle, she might have been talking about some of the weaknesses that we've heard that were internal to the FBI there.
Well, obviously, in any organization, you have to hope that your leadership realizes that the most information comes from those with the leather on the street. And obviously, the way you build a capability is from the street up. The talk about sources and informants is extremely important. During my tenure, we went after organized crime, and our best weapon was not wiretaps. It was human sources that we developed inside the organized crime element. And that sort of approach is certainly going to be necessary once the Bureau is empowered to undertake it in the area of the threat from the radical Islamic elements. And that brings in the difficulty in this country of the freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. which make us very hesitant to try and penetrate those groups that are associated in a religious context.
Let's get another caller in. This is Griffin, who's with us from Arkadelphia, Arkansas.
Yes, I have a real quick question that I've wondered about this new agency. What is going to be the difference between it and the National Security Agency?
Phil Girardi, the National Security Agency is involved in overseeing electronic intelligence gathering of various types.
Yeah, I think what Buck can correct me on this, but I think what's being envisioned is following the model of MI6, you would have a domestic intelligence organization that would pretty much operate like the CIA does overseas, where you would recruit sources, where you would collect information technically, and basically you would operate in that fashion. The NSA currently does technical collection. That's all it does.
Okay.
Thanks for the call, Griffin.
All right, thank you.
Hearings have gotten back underway this afternoon. Robert Mueller, the current director of the FBI, is talking. But before he began, staff members read another report. This is Kristen Healy reading from the staff statement this afternoon. She said the staff found that the FBI has improved its performance, but there is still much work to be done.
Recruitment of sources has increased, but agents recognize more sources are needed. Michael Rollins, who at the time was acting assistant director of the Washington Field Office, told us that although the FBI knows 10 times more now about the radical Islamic community in his territory than it did before 9/11, its knowledge is at about 20 on a scale of 1 to 100. A supervisor of an international terrorism squad told us the FBI has not adequately reached out to the communities in which it should be developing sources. He believes that while agents are complying with the FBI's policy that they investigate any lead that comes in, other systematic collection work is left undone.
And before we leave this subject, Buck Revelle, get a quick reaction to what you just heard from Kristen Healy there.
I think those are probably very legitimate criticisms. I think that the spigot was just turned on after 9/11, essentially allowing an all-out push to develop sources throughout the radical Islamic community. You have to be very careful not to intrude into the legitimate community that certainly is the predominant one. It's a startup program because they've just been unleashed and allowed to go out and do what we should have been able to do all along.
Buck Revelle, thanks very much for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
Buck Revelle, an associate deputy director of the FBI, was with us on the phone from his office in Dallas, Texas. And Phil Giraldi, we appreciate your time, too.
Thank you.
Phil Giraldi was a counterterrorism specialist at the CIA. He joined us here in Studio 3A. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.